So Lockwood, you and I have spoken many, many times about kind of this concept of I'm a trust and estates lawyer, but what prong am I going to hang my hat on?
Right.
There's no need to just prepare a trust for the sake of saying we prepared a trust. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a very significant purpose that is brought to the table by the client to create a trust agreement. Now, a trust agreement, as we've said many times, is just simply a contract,
right,
an agreement between the creator of the trust and its trustee for the sake of a beneficiary. We're going to talk about a very interesting trust this morning. Lockwood, we've talked about special needs trust. We've talked about trust for second and third marriages. We've talked about trust to protect assets from the long-term care of a nursing home. We've talked about trust, of course, for minor children and who need a trustee and a guardian if, God forbid, something were to happen to their parent. So there are all sorts of different factual scenarios that I will hear as a trust lawyer, Lockwood, at the conference table that will then signal me toward the trust agreement that would accomplish those particular clients' objectives and their goals.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go. This is going to be a kind of a juicy one, Lockwood. We're going to call this the in-law trust, okay? Yeah, this is for that daughter-in-law or that son-in-law who, yes, our daughter, our son went out and got married, and they married John or Sue or Stephanie, but I don't know about that marriage. And I, as a parent, am very concerned that if I leave my estate 50-50 to my two children, then and particularly to my daughter, that if their marriage doesn't hold and they go through a divorce, then my assets, our assets that we've worked so hard to have, if we just leave them to our daughter, aren't they going to be part of the divorce?
Mm-hmm.
And so here we go, Lockwood. Now, like everything in the law, it's a little bit, we have to give a background here. It is true in the state of North Carolina that inherited separate property, gifted property from a parent or a grandparent or from anyone really is separate property. And it is not subject to marital divorce. It isn't marriage property. After all, those are not assets that the husband and the wife created during their marriage. And so therefore they are not marital assets and they do not get split in the way that most of our listeners know, generally speaking, 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's real easy to say. But when you inherit, you know, let's just use a number, $500,000 from your mom or dad, and bless your heart, you've lost your mom or dad at this point, we might add. They've died. And you've inherited, let's say, $500,000. It's very, very difficult, Lockwood, to keep that separate.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to pay off your mortgage.
Right.
You might want to use that to buy, you know, that wonderful home in the mountains of North Carolina that you and your husband have really wanted. You might want to get a nice boat.
Mm-hmm.
Not that a boat is $500,000 or most boats aren't, but just a nice boat, which, you know, or anything that you do. You might want to put on that back porch.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to do an addition to your home. There are so many things out there, and all of a sudden you've inherited $500,000. And so what most folks end up doing is that they use those monies to improve, if you will, their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, they accidentally commingle what was inherited property now with marital property. This then becomes a real problem when this marriage, for whatever reason, fails.
Right.
And now, of course, the monies that the person inherited from their parents or grandparents, which used to be separate property, are not separate property because they got commingled in the marital life.
Right.
So the solution to this problem is that, and it's always interesting, Lockwood, you know, the client brings the issues to the table, as I've said a couple times mm-hmm. already today. I mean, I don't really usually know all of the details about Mr. and Mrs. Jones. They have to come in, sit down with me, let me kind of in a confidential way, of course, hear the facts and circumstances of their life and their children, the pieces of their puzzle. And they are the ones that will then bring to the table that, you know, well, we are very concerned about our daughter and her marriage. They've mm-hmm. already been separated one time before. They're right. back together now, but I'm not real sure that that marriage is going to hold. I don't want half of our estate, right. you know, to float to her and then be lost in a divorce.
Right.
And so if we listen carefully to the client as a lawyer, then the lawyer will lead us in terms of what documentation is needed in order to meet the objective of the client.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I bring this up because I just this week had these facts presented to me by a nice married couple who actually have three children, but were very concerned about this issue. And so the solution to this issue is that the child would not inherit outright the assets through inheritance from their parent. They would not just, you know, get title to the stock account, title to, you know, the home place, the uh-huh. real property or investment property that the parents happen to have. During the settlement of the estate of the parent, the title would not go directly to the child. And so, Lockwood, where does it go? It goes into a trust, into this what we might call today an in-law trust.
Okay.
So the assets now are suspended in a trust. This does not mean that the daughter cannot get to the assets in the trust. She can certainly receive all of the income off of that trust. She can receive even the principal if she is inclined to take out, you know, a couple of $100,000 or whatever amount it is.
Right.
All of this is relative, as we know, Lockwood, to the amount of monies that are involved, the amount of the estate.
Uh-huh.
And I will be straightforward in saying that usually when this issue comes up at the conference table, it isn't necessarily, Lockwood, $500,000.
Right, right.
It's significantly more than that.
Mm-hmm.
The child is going to inherit, you know, several million dollars,
mm-hmm.
and the parent is concerned about the safety of these of this very significant inheritance in light of the fact that their child is married and in light of the fact that their child has had some marital issues.
Right.
So these funds, these assets pass into a trust. The child, which is an adult child. I mean, we're
right.
talking about a child here that might be 40, 50, 60 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the assets are suspended, if you will, Lockwood, in a trust for their benefit. Now, if we're going to be reciprocal and do this for both children, let's say, for both sister and brother, and have this in-law trust applicable for all of our children, then it's very, very nice for the children to be the co-trustee of this trust for each other.
Uh-huh.
That makes perfect sense. The sister can kind of be the trustee for her brother. The brother can be the trustee for the sister. They can even be co-trustees of each of the trust. That's a real nice scenario when it works in a file, because now they both, you know, even Stephen, they both are involved in each other's life. They understand how these assets were inherited,
right.
and they want to protect each other. And so the trustee is an important conversation. Who would be the trustee of the trust? But the bottom line is that now, Lockwood, let's go further. The documentation, think of the documentation on this. It's just wonderful. I mean, first of all, there's a written trust agreement that the mom and dad created that showed that the inherited assets go into the trust for the benefit of their adult child. Mm-hmm. That is a written contract that can be handed up to the divorce lawyers and to the divorce court judges.
Right.
It's documentation. It's some of the very best documentation to establish the separateness of the assets under North Carolina law. Next, of course, there would be, as to stocks and bonds and liquidity, there would be a trust account. These would be titled in the name of that trust. Uh-huh. And so the daughter's lawyer the daughter and the daughter's lawyer is able to show the court, look, you know, I never took title to this million-dollar portfolio. It's over here at Schwab or Fidelity. Here it is in the name of the trust that my parents created. I have lived off of the income, but I have not taken any of the principal and commingled it with our marital assets. So, so there's a lot of good documentation in this file. And I'm not a divorce lawyer, but I know enough to know that this issue that we're talking about this afternoon of separate property, marital property, my divorce lawyer friends tell me that it is a nightmare to document that the inherited assets stayed separate. It's just very difficult to document that. And keep in mind the divorce at this point in the divorce court, Lockwood, you know, it's a contested matter.
Right.
Many times at this point. And there are lawyers on both sides arguing the different positions. And so the documentation is critical. The beauty of this in-law trust for those folks who desire to have it created and want to discuss it in the conference is that it's just such strong documentation of the separateness of the inheritance.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about an issue that he and I have discussed on numerous occasions, and that's related to trusts. And by the way, as I continue this conversation, I just want to remind you, don't hesitate to give either Cecil or his partner, Wes Collins, a call, but definitely Cecil on the issue of trust and estates. That's his forte. And that number, 252 area code, 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to Harvell and, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. This issue of the in-law trust, there's several aspects of this that I want to go back to something you said many years ago, over the years we've talked about this. You just don't willy-nilly create a trust. You've created a trust because there's a purpose. And here's an example of just one purpose, and that is to protect the assets for the issue of a family, the children of a family, to assure that the assets and the benefits accrue directly to their children, as opposed to possibly being siphoned off into a divorce circumstance to a third party. I'll use that description. You know, the other aspect of this trust, and I'm curious about this, is the potential growth. Let's say you have an in-law trust for, in this case, a daughter, but that daughter also has children. And so the ability to transfer that money directly through that daughter to their grandchildren, and this particularly the now would be the grandparents, is there a procedure for doing that, again, to avoid any potential abuse? I'll use that term.
I like to speak of things, and we talked about this last week when we were talking about the prenuptial agreement, the prior marriage agreement, or even a postnuptial agreement. What I like to make folks try to understand, Lockwood, is the control This in-law trust just simply gives the daughter control.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that she can't use the money to educate her children in college.
Right.
That's what her parents would want her to do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even mean that she can't take out, you know, $500,000 and go buy a home on the mountaintop in
right.
Boone, North Carolina. She can do all of those things, but she's doing them in an intelligent and with legal guidance, and she's doing them because she intends to do them,
uh-huh.
understanding the consequences of what she is doing. Now, as to the home in the mountaintop, you know, or maybe they live in that western part of the state and they want a home here, you know, in the promised land, Lockwood,
mm-hmm, right,
that
right.
real estate can be titled in the name of the trust, you see, in
oh,
the
really?
Name of the in-law trust. No one said that she needed to use the money and title it in her individual name, which would confuse whether or not it stayed separate and distinct as marital property. The trust is an entity, a legal entity, with a federal ID number, and it can buy property. It can buy a cabin, if you will, in the mountains or a house down here at the beach. It can do any of those things, but it very clearly documents the trail, if you will. You know, the assets were inherited into this trust. The daughter then had the trust buy the second home in the
uh-huh.
mountains or down at the beach, whatever the case might be. But absolutely, she can, with the of course consent of the trustee, who would not have a problem with that, you know, pass assets out of that trust on down to her children, who are, you know, the grandchildren of the creator of the trust.
Okay, so
now again, Lockwood, some of our listeners are just thinking, "Wow, that's a lot of strings attached." Well, you know, that depends on, as I alluded to, Lockwood, the values that we're talking about
right,
here.
Right, right.
And values, even though they say that we economically are struggling, some people, I know people who mm-hmm. are, absolutely, there's not any question about it. And my heart goes out to so many folks who are struggling financially. But yet, on the other hand, there are these folks that just have all the assets in the world. And it's those folks who sometimes will come to see a trust lawyer like myself and bring up these issues. I've even heard issues where a lot of times these folks, again, with high net worth, Lockwood, they will want something to be set aside for their grandchildren,
right,
the next generation, who let's say are, you know, 25 to 35 years old.
Right.
Lo and behold, their daughter has already gone through a divorce.
Right.
And many of the assets that the parents had gifted to their daughter through the years got all, you know, tied up in the contested divorce
mm-hmm.
proceeding, and she lost a lot of assets.
Right.
So now when grandmama, granddaddy come in, they've already been through this one time in their life.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to make doggone certain that as to these assets that pass to these grandchildren in their 20s, 25, 30, 35, who are now just getting married, are in these in-law trusts. So people bring their life story to the conference table. They bring the circumstances that have affected their home. And that's what we do as a trust lawyer. We listen carefully to these circumstances. And then that leads us into the kind of document that particular client would need. But absolutely, Lockwood, we just don't go into an appointment and just say, well, now you know you need a trust.
Right.
Because you may not need a trust, okay? You've got to be able, we have to be able, you know, ethically and legally to justify why we are creating a trust agreement for clients.
You know, Cecil, last week we were talking about, again, that issue of prenuptial agreements, and you've commented several times, look, this is just a contract. This is not, there's no nefarious, adversarial or nefarious intention here. It's just a contract, a protective contract. And one of the things that we've talked about in the past. And I think that as I've heard these conversations over and over again, is the fact that in many instances, what you're also doing is addressing the issue of, if you will, state law. And one of the items that we mentioned last week was that term elective shares. That is something that I think quite often we fail to realize. There are certain factors or legal decisions that have already been made by the state that are absolutely, you know, concrete. So I'm thinking this issue of a trust of this nature, an in-law trust, avoids something like that on the elective shares. Am I thinking correctly?
Well, you're absolutely correct that, and I hope I'm making sense when I say what these documents do is give the client control.
Oh, right.
That's just a very, very wonderful, valuable thing to have in your toolbox is control.
Uh-huh.
And as to these in-law trusts, yes, the law in North Carolina is that separate property is separate and marital property is marital. But then there are case after case after case after case where folks take the separate property, build onto the house,
uh-huh,
add a garage, put in a swimming pool, you know, improve the pier, buy a boat, buy a house in the mountains, whatever the case might be. And very, very quickly, the law then dictates that those funds became marital property.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention just divorce lawyers being able to document these kinds of things. So yes, these hard and fast laws exist by our North Carolina legislature, like the elective share, that a spouse, no matter what we say, has an interest in the estate of their spouse who has died.
Mm-hmm.
That's the law in North Carolina. The law in North Carolina is that marital property is split 50-50.
Okay.
Separate property can easily become marital property. So these are absolutely laws that exist. And what the trust does,
mm-hmm,
is give the client the control over when and where these laws apply. It's very, very often in a premarital contract that, of course, it waives the elective share, but the client will come back 5 years later, 7 years later. I think I actually have that happening this week, maybe tomorrow, where the client is coming back and they've been married for a while. They did have a prenuptial, but he now is including the wife in a very, very significant way in his estate planning, because he is now ready to do that.
Mm.
And his children are even ready for that to happen. The prenuptial is there to give him the control,
mm-hmm,
to be able to come in now on Thursday and exactly say, this is how I want it to be. And guess what? That is how it will be, because he has
control.
The premarital contract.
Right.
That's right. He maintained his control. And this in-law trust is the same. As I said, the daughter can use the funds to educate her children. She can gift some of the funds on a way to the grandchildren. She can do all sorts of things with the trust. She has control over those assets, okay? But it's been documented very, very clearly that they are separate assets, and they stay separate until she exercises her control otherwise.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell about an in-law trust for just a few more minutes here on Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell. And, of course, remind you, harvellandcollins.com and the number 252, area code 726-9050. Cecil, quick question on the issue of the trustee in the case of an in-law trust, or for that matter, I guess any trust, but particularly this one. Obviously, the issue of the trustee, how does the trustee go about communicating with either the creators of the trust or the recipient of the trust? How do you go about that process?
Well, first of all, the issue of who the trustee is is something that we really do have to discuss carefully with the client. And it does require some real guidance by we trust lawyers.
Okay.
There are many times when we are preparing a trust agreement, Lockwood, that the person can actually be the trustee of their own trust, like the daughter we keep caught in this conversation this afternoon.
Uh-huh.
We keep referring to this daughter who maybe is in a fragile marriage, unfortunately. She can be the trustee of this in-law trust. It is nice when there, I would advise to the client that if a good brother or sister exists in this file, then it would be nice to have her in a co-position, not necessarily 100% as trustee, but as a co-trustee with her brother or sister. Now, if, as I mentioned before, if the clients are setting this up unilaterally across the board for each and every child, both of their children or all three of their children, then obviously it's perfect for the children to be the co-trustees of this in-law trust for each other,
right.
Okay? And that is many times where we land in these facts. The elective share trust, believe it or not, Lockwood, the elective share trust, which is for the benefit of a spouse in a second marriage, or third marriage, or it doesn't have to be,
right.
I guess, a second or third marriage, just a spouse, that trustee cannot be the spouse. It has to be someone independent. There has to be an independent trustee. And this sometimes can create a little bit of a pause in terms of finding that person. It might end up being the brother or the sister of the creator, maybe, you know, a niece or a nephew. But we're going to need to, in those files, find someone that can be independent of the elective share assets. So you are absolutely correct. We've got to talk about who the trustee is, and the lawyer is very, very important in this conversation, because the lawyer will know who can and cannot be the trustee, what are the best circumstances practically for the trustee. Now, it used to be, Lockwood, and I might get in trouble here a little bit, but I know you know what I'm talking about. It used to be when I was, and this was back when I started practicing law, there really wasn't a week that went by that I didn't have the trust company of First Citizens in my office,
mm-hmm.
the trust company of Wachovia,
right.
that was what it was called back then, a wonderful guy by the name of Rick Britt.
Right.
You may even know Rick. Rick is, by the way, just retired.
Mm-hmm.
I had, of course, BB&T. They had a very strong trust department. And the list just went on and on and on. I had extraordinary professional relationships
right.
with what they were known as the trust officers
mm-hmm.
of the various banking institutions. And we used these banking institutions in our documents. We named them as trustee
right.
many, many times. That our world has changed now, Lockwood,
yeah.
and they are not really very excited about being the trustee of a trust in kind of these mom and pop situations, which is what we talked about last week
right.
and we talked about this week, Lockwood. You know, if a client, you know, and this is just very, very rare, but I mean, if a client has $50 million or $100 million, you know, just extraordinary wealth, now for some reason,
yeah.
the banks will come in and maybe help the
right.
wealth management side of the bank be a trustee.
Right.
But as to our mom and pop files, the banks are not staffed as they used to
mm-hmm.
be, nor are they seeking that business. And so back to your question, Lockwood, we really do sometimes have to think hard about who the trustee might be, because your question also, though, was about communication.
Right.
And it is critical that it be someone that we can communicate with. Absolutely. In an elective share trust, for instance, the spouse would very much be in the conversation as to, well, who would this trustee be?
Right.
Maybe it can be the spouse's sister, mm-hmm. or the spouse's brother, or niece or nephew. There needs to be some connection between that spouse who is being left assets in trust and her trustee. As one can imagine, that needs to be someone that she feels comfortable with.
Yeah. That was the question I was curious about. Before we wrap things up with you, again, Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins with us, one quick question on the issue of trustees. Can they be changed? Is it reasonable to make a change in the process of a trust if for some reason, for example, maybe the trustee is no longer with us, he dies or she dies, but there's some reason for change? Is it easy to make those changes without having to reinvent the entire document?
Yes, and we look for that.
Okay.
We always first begin with, you know, what is the most direct, efficient, simple, and even cost-effective way, if you will, Lockwood, to meet the client's objective. And many times a trust can be modified, there can be an amendment, there can be what we lawyers call a restatement of the trust, but with a little bit different provisions. So we are always looking for options like that. Sometimes I'll explain it like this. I'll say, but Mr. and Mrs. Jones, right now, we don't even have the house built. We don't have the foundation. We don't have the roof. We don't have any of your documentation built. Let's build the foundational documents and get those in place. And then if in a few years you need to come back and make a modification,
okay.
That's very easy for us to do.